Now, for your quiz enjoyment. Number one, who were the first three kings of the nation of Israel? Nathan? Saul, David, and Solomon. And it's not entirely agreed upon as to how long Saul ruled. Some people say 32 years, some say 40. But David and Solomon both reigned 40 years. Moses' life can be divided up into three 40-year periods. The first three rules of Israel can basically be divided up into three 40-year periods as well. Number two, in what year did Israel become two different nations? Now, you could have got this off your timeline. Nathan? 931 B.C. And why did this happen? Why did Israel break away from Judah? Why did a nation break away from the line of David? The reason why there's any good revolution, taxes. There was a tax increase. Solomon's son by the name of Rehoboam wanted to raise taxes, and Israel said, then we're out of here. Maybe Texas ought to do something like that. The sovereign nation of Texas. That would be good. Sounds good to me. Okay, number three. Who was the last judge of Israel?
Samuel.
Whoops. I didn't put that one down. The last judge of Israel was Samuel. It was not what was coming up on the screen. What was coming up on the screen was the answer number four. Who took Israel captive? Assyria. Now, if you notice in all those slides that we looked at of all those nations, there's a part that's to the south and the central part of all those maps that nobody wanted to live. That was the desert area. But everybody would go from the two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates, and come across and go down to Israel. That was what was known as the Fertile Crescent. And Assyria was over there in Nineveh between the two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates. And Assyria became a great nation. And it came against Israel and defeated it in what year? This is on your timeline. 722 B.C. There's not a lot of dates that are significantly important, but 722 B.C., when Israel goes into captivity, I would say is one of the more important biblical dates. Number five, what country took Judah captive? Babylon. And in what year did they take Babylon captive? Now, Babylon also comes from the Tigris and the Euphrates. It's just that it was a little more south and east of Nineveh. Nineveh was up here at the top of the Fertile Crescent. Babylon was down here at the far end of the Fertile Crescent. It comes around and comes down and attacks Judah. And it took people captive actually in 3 years. The one that's known as the final one is 586 B.C. That was when Judah no longer existed as a nation. But Babylon under King Nebuchadnezzar also took captives in 605 B.C. and 597 B.C. I believe Daniel is agreed upon by scholars to have gone into captivity in 605 B.C., and that Ezekiel went into captivity in 597 B.C., but everybody left, except the poorest of the land, in 586 B.C. Number six, who led Israel out of Egypt?
Moses.
And who led Israel into the Promised Land?
Joshua.
Why didn't Moses? He was what? He struck the rock twice when he was told to just hold his rod toward the rock the second time. He got angry with the nation of Israel, lost his temper, and hit the rock a second time. Since the rock was a picture of Christ, the rock was not supposed to be struck twice. And so Moses did not get to go into the promised land. He went up on Mount Pisgah, I think it was called, and got to see the promised land from afar, but did not get to go in.
Was anything mentioned in the Bible that part of his punishment was also for breaking the two stone tablets, or was that just...
No. It was just about the rock. Okay, number 7. What Persian ruler allowed the Jews to return back to Israel? Cyrus. Now, no Babylonian ruler did. And you saw the kingdom of Babylon up there from the Tigris-Euphrates along the Fertile Crescent. And then you saw that big yellow kingdom, the Persian kingdom. That's the kind kingdom. That's the nice kingdom. Cyrus, although he would whoop you, he would then be nice to you after he beat you up. So after he beat you up, he let you go back to your... country. Actually, he didn't have to beat up Israel. Israel was already in captivity. But once he took power in Persia, he was kind to the captives and allowed them to return home. He figured, although God was obviously in charge and working sovereignly to move Cyrus to allow the Jews to return, his thought process was, if we let the peoples worship their own gods in their own way, they'll be better citizens. So let them go home and be productive. That was his thought. Okay, number 8. When the nation of Israel became two nations, what were the name of the two nations? Israel and Judah. Where were the two nations located? Israel was located in the... north. Its first king was Jeroboam the first, because there's another Jeroboam in the line, not in the line, but in the succession of kings. One thing you need to know about the kings of Israel versus the kings of Judah, all the kings of Judah were kings by birth. They were in the line of David. The kings of Israel were kings by might. Whoever could assassinate and take the throne did so. And Jeroboam the first and Jeroboam the second are not related, and they're certainly not in the line of David, but not all the kings and the kings of Israel are related, because there's assassinations and overthrows and coups in the northern kingdom where there's the line of David in the southern kingdom. And its capital city was Samaria. Now, its capital city may not have been Samaria at the very beginning, but it ended up being the capital city. And the other kingdom was Judah. It was obviously located in the south, and the king that caused all this division was Rehoboam, Solomon's son. So he becomes the first king of Judah. And the capital city of the southern kingdom? Jerusalem. So the southern kingdom is the kingdom that was, I guess you could say, the correct kingdom. Nevertheless, does anybody know why, besides taxes, why the nation of Israel split from the nation of Judah? That was part of it. There was always a skirmish between these two parts of Israel. But anybody know why the nation of Israel separated from the land of Judah? It was whose fault? Solomon's. What did Solomon do? He had many wives, and what did his wives do? Led him astray into pagan idolatry and idolatrous worship. And God told Solomon, because you have done this, your kingdom will be stripped from you. Yet there will still be a part left because of my covenant to David, but I'm taking this kingdom away from you and I'm giving it to your servant, Jeroboam. And that's why Jeroboam is the first king of Israel, because God said so. And that's why Jerusalem remained the capital city in the southern kingdom, because that's the way it was intended. But the split between Israel and Judah, although it can be attributed to Rehoboam raising taxes and getting Israel mad at him, it does say it came about from the Lord, because the Lord desired to split this nation in two because of Solomon's sins. I believe the reason for that is because 10 tribes are in the northern kingdom and only 2 tribes are in the southern kingdom, and the 2 tribes in the southern kingdom are Judah and Benjamin. So the southern kingdom was called by basically the most significant tribe, where it would have been difficult to determine which was the most significant tribe. You had 10 tribes in the northern kingdom, Israel. Okay, number 9, who were the leaders of the 3 Jewish returns from Persia to Israel? Who was the first guy?
Zerubbabel.
Zerubbabel was a descendant of David. He was never a king, but he was the governor. And the date at which he returned from Persia was about 538 to 535 BC. This is when Cyrus said you could go back. So Zerubbabel leads a whole mess of people back to Israel, and the accomplishment or the achievement which he is credited with is what? The rebuilding of the temple. They went back, they began to rebuild the temple, and opposition arose. So they stopped. And the prophets Haggai and Zechariah were raised up and told to tell Zerubbabel and Joshua, get back to work and finish the temple. And in 520, during the ministries of Zechariah and Haggai, the temple began to be rebuilt again and was finished in 515 BC. So Zerubbabel was sent back. He rebuilds the temple after some opposition and some encouragement from the 2 prophets. Who was the second leader of a return to Israel? Who?
Ezra.
Ezra went back in 458 BC, about 100 years, 90 years, I guess, if you, or 80 years if you subtract correctly. But significantly later than Zerubbabel, 80 years later, he leads a group back, and his achievement is basically he restores the people. After 80 years, the people had, you know what it's like. You're coming back, you're all excited, you're getting back to go in the land and everything's good. You're going to do what's right because you went into captivity because of your sins. So you're not going to practice those things anymore. And so you're going to be a good little group of people. After 80 years, things start deteriorating. Well, Ezra goes back and restores the people. It's interesting, the book of Ezra can be divided up into 2 sections. And one section is the return under Zerubbabel, and one section is the return under Ezra. And they're 80 years apart. But as you read the book of Ezra, it sounds like it's almost back-to-back, and it isn't. So you need to be aware of those dates. And the third return to Israel was led by Nehemiah. Nehemiah was a contemporary with Ezra. He went back in 445 or 444 BC, which is about 14 years after Ezra. So Ezra and Nehemiah were probably crossing each other's paths along the Fertile Crescent as one was going back to Persia and one was coming to the Promised Land. What did Nehemiah accomplish? He built the walls. He rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem. They were in terrible shape. He was mocked and ridiculed for doing it. And he's the guy that basically said something like, praise the Lord and pack the ammunition or something like that. He had a trowel in one hand and a sword in the other. So as they were building the walls, they were ready for anybody who tried to come against them. They had the weapons and the tools at the same time. So they were ready for everything. Okay, on your brain burner, one of the things I wanted to bring to your attention on number one, I don't have any answers on the board. Several nations mentioned in the Old Testament, we've already mentioned several of them, and there were several others shown on the overhead tonight. Are they in existence in the world today? Which ones are still in existence? Israel, Egypt. I don't know if Lebanon was, yeah, I guess Lebanon, the cedars of Lebanon. The Hittites were in Turkey. I don't know if there's a Hittite nation anymore. But most of those nations aren't in existence today. But can you give me one of them that has a promise of a future existence? Babylon. Babylon's going to be a nation again. It's not one now, because what exists there now? Iraq. And maybe part of Iran. Now, if you open your Bibles, I meant to look this up, so I could be in error here, so excuse me for having to look, but I think it's in Amos. Yes, it's in Amos. If you look at verse 3, it says, for three transgressions of Damascus and for four. Now, Damascus was the capital city of a country known as Syria. Chapter 1 of Amos, verse 3. Verse 6 says, for three transgressions of Gaza. That's the Philistines. Verse 9 says, for three transgressions of Tyre. Verse 11 says, for three transgressions of Edom. Verse 13 says, for three transgressions of Ammon. Chapter 2, verse 1 says, for three transgressions of Moab. Verse 4 says, for three transgressions of Judah. And verse 6 says, for three transgressions of Israel. And each time God says, I will not revoke its punishment. These are nations that surrounded Israel, that were nations at the time of Israel, that got eliminated from the face of the earth. They sort of exist in some sort of form today. They're still Syria. They're still the city of Damascus, but they're not the countries they were. There's one country that remains on the face of the earth, and even as we looked at the map, even though it's a very tiny country, it remains on the face of the map for a particular reason, and that's the nation of Israel. And it's interesting how such a little country can cause such a huge disturbance in the world. But that's the way it is, because of the forces of evil against the forces of good. Okay, did anybody else have anything they wanted to say about the brain burner number one or number three? Okay, let's go over number two real quickly. It says, sometimes a person, an event, or an activity has a greater significance than itself alone. We call those things pictures, shadows, or types. An example would be the sacrificial system given by God to the Levites on behalf of Israel. This was a picture or a shadow of Christ's work on the cross. Can you think of any other examples of shadows or types in the Old Testament? The rock was Christ, and that's specifically mentioned in the book of Corinthians, that the rock was Christ. The bronze serpent. The bronze serpent. That's given to us in John 3:15, I guess, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up. So that's pretty clear that that was a illustration of Christ as well, that you look to the bronze serpent for deliverance. You don't look at your problems, you look at the one who can deliver you. What? Okay, Abraham and Isaac, the one that we've already studied, where Abraham was asked to take his son Isaac and sacrifice him. In the book of Hebrews, does anybody know what's specifically said as a shadow or a type? Melchizedek. That's an excellent answer. I wasn't thinking of that, but that's an excellent answer. Melchizedek is a type of Christ. There's a lot of things in the book of Hebrews that says basically the whole Old Testament was a shadow or a picture. But one of the things it particularly mentions is the tabernacle. And the things in the tabernacle spoke of things that were greater than the tabernacle themselves. Okay, now on the last question on number two on the brain burner. How would you consider Israel's deliverance from Egypt, the crossing of the Red Sea, and the crossing of the Jordan into the promised land in this subject of shadows, types, or pictures? Is Israel's deliverance from Egypt a picture or a type of anything? Okay, now he's adding a lot of maybes because he doesn't want to be found wrong. And who does? We all want to be right. Is it maybe something like us being delivered from sin and into righteousness? Would you say that that's a picture of that? I would. What is the event that Israel was to remember throughout all of history? The Passover. And is Christ called our Passover? Yes, he is. So Passover, associated with the deliverance from Egypt, Israel's deliverance from Egypt, would certainly be a type of Christ. What about the crossing of the Red Sea? Okay, is it a type of baptism? Actually, it says in the book of Corinthians they were all baptized into Moses in the Red Sea. What's interesting is not a single person who was baptized in the Red Sea got wet. So that's interesting. What? And even though they got baptized in the Red Sea, they didn't go into the Promised Land. That's the point that Paul's making. And why didn't they? They didn't believe. And Paul's point is, you can be associated with something and be so close to the reality and so close to what is a blessing and be so far away at the same time. I wouldn't say so, but I know there would be some people who do. And that's one of the things I'm trying to get at. In fact, now that you mention that, I should have put something else down here. Crossing of the Red Sea, Israel was supposed to remember that. Why were they supposed to remember that? And his great love and mercy and his power. That demonstrated the great love, mercy, and power of God. Is there anything too difficult for the Lord? He can split a sea in half and have you walk on dry land and drown the entire Egyptian army in the same location. It is a reminder to the children that we must trust the Lord. Remember the Passover. It was because of the blood on the doorpost that the death angel crossed over us, not because of our works. It wasn't because we were mightier than the Egyptians. It was because God delivered us, and it was a time to remember everything that God did. Now, what is the significant event in the New Testament that we are to remember always? His resurrection. Certainly his death. There is no resurrection without his death, but his resurrection. That speaks of what? His mercy, power, and love. Now we've gone beyond splitting a sea, which we can somewhat begin to see, but now we have a power that's beyond that. We have power over death, sin, and hell. A resurrection power. So does the Red Sea prefigure the resurrection? I don't think so. I think they're both examples of God's power, love, and mercy, but I don't necessarily see one as picturing the other as I would the rock picturing Christ, the Passover picturing Christ, because we have specific verses about that. What about Israel crossing of the Jordan River into the Promised Land? Is that a picture of anything? Nathan? Maybe us going to Christ in heaven. Okay, is that what you said? Did I misunderstand? Going through Christ to heaven. So the Promised Land is heaven. Any other ideas? And he prefaced that one with a big maybe too. Because maybe not. It certainly speaks of God's fulfillment of his promise. But does it prefigure or typify or shadow something of greater significance than that? I would definitely agree that it shows God's power, He split the river again, and it shows his faithfulness to his promise. Absolutely. But does it prefigure something? Nathan's saying, does it prefigure, does it typify, does it shadow an individual's entrance into heaven? What did Israel have to do after they crossed through Jordan River? Well, they did, but what did they do after that? Who led them into the promised land across the Jordan River? Joshua. What did Joshua also do for them? He was their what? Somewhat, but he was more than that. He was their general. What was he getting ready to do for the nation of Israel? Fight wars, lead them into battle. Is that what you think of when you think of entering into heaven? Fighting wars and fighting battles against giants and invaders of the land. I don't deny that, but that's not what was suggested by Nathan, then that's not what's suggested by a lot of people. What is suggested by a lot of people is the crossing of the Jordan River by Israel into the promised land, because it's the promised land, that is a type of entering into heaven. And my contention with that is they got into the promised land, but then they had to fight for it. They had to remove the people who didn't belong there. And the people who didn't belong there didn't belong there because they had sinned. Their cup of iniquity was full. Now, does that picture what you think of as heaven? Or do you think of heaven as a place of rest? Because Joshua didn't give them rest. Joshua gave them war. So what could the crossing of the Jordan be a shadow of? Maybe it's the entrance into the Christian walk. That you begin your Christian walk and now what is before you? A battle. I would accept that a whole lot quicker than entrance into heaven. But I don't accept either one personally. I think it's just that Israel crossed into the promised land because God was faithful to his promise. Yes, Valerie. No, I'd like to hear your comment.
Well, I was just going to say something about, you know, how Jesus is like the living water. Where you
come in,
the Holy Spirit
comes
upon you and directs you in your path.
Yes, there's the idea of the Holy Spirit being likened to water and directing your paths. And I agree with all that. But to say that when I read about Joshua crossing the Jordan River, I'm supposed to understand that, I think you're now allowing for yourself to understand anything you want to about any passage. And that's what I'm trying to get us away from. And I'll tell you another one in a minute. That's an excellent question. And why were the battle plans to march around Jericho and have the walls come down, but the battle plans against Ai was to trick them to come out of the city and then race in there and burn it down? I don't know. It certainly was so that the children would be taught the power, mercy, and love of God and the faithfulness of God. That it would be something very graphic that would never be forgotten. So I understand that. But if the nation of Israel had obeyed God in the first place, they would have never crossed the Jordan River. They would have cut up the southern portion of the promised land and taken the promised land. Why did they not do that? because the 12 spies who went out to spy out the land said that we can't do it. So they wandered around the wilderness for 40 years and ended up over here on the side of the Jordan River and crossed the Jordan River. But they were at the south part of the Promised Land when that happened. All they had to do was cut straight up the middle if they would have believed. So why did it happen one way and not another? I don't know that. And as my students know very well, there will be no why questions asked and answered in class. I have no idea why. We're looking for what and hows. Yes.
So it seems dangerous to make something symbolic, or are you saying it's dangerous just to teach on a passage and relate it to a spiritual truth? Is there a difference?
Let's say we relate the crossing of the Red Sea or the crossing of the Jordan River to the faithfulness, power, mercy, and love of God. I see no problem with that at all. And to then say, how do we see the power, mercy, love, and God today? Through the work of Christ. I have no problem doing that. What I have a problem with is saying the crossing of the Jordan River should cause us to think of Christ. Or think of heaven. Or that it's God showing us the way into heaven. I don't get that. Let me give you another one that I've read before. Moses is not wanting to go to Egypt and lead the children of Israel out of Egypt, right? So he says, who's going to send me? God says, I am. He says, I haven't really been good at speaking, and he says, who made your mouth? And one of the things Moses contended was, what if the people don't believe? He said, what's that in your hand? He said, a staff. He said, throw it down. He threw it down, and it became a serpent, right? He says, now take it up. He took it up, and it became a staff again. He said, reach into your bosom and pull your hand out, and it will be leprous. Now put it back in your bosom, pull it out, and now it won't be leprous. Those will be the signs that show the nation of Israel you're the guy. I've read commentaries that say when Moses threw his staff down and it became a serpent, that was a picture of God throwing Satan out of heaven. Where do you get that? Did God throw Satan out of heaven? Is Satan the great serpent? Okay, so you're going to put the two together and say that that's what the nation of Israel should have seen? What was the nation of Israel supposed to see in that? The power of God for what purpose? To listen to Moses. Yeah, and then he takes the serpent back up again. So when you start doing things like that, you get in big trouble with taking the analogy too far. Now, I say that because even one of the songs we've been singing talks about crossing the Jordan. Are y'all aware of that? Do y'all know what song I'm talking about? You guys got to pay attention to what you say. Good night. We've sung it all, not all of you. Some of y'all are exempt, but some of y'all are not exempt. I'm not saying we shouldn't sing the song. I'm not saying we shouldn't sing the verse. But it's hymn number 439. And it's the hymn, He Leadeth Me. Now, why should we know about this? It's the hymn of the month. We've been singing it all month long. So you could be in Dallas today, but you were here last week. Notice verse 4. And when my task on earth is done, I mean, he's dying, right? When by thy grace the victory's won, excellent theology, even death's cold wave I will not flee, again, excellent theology, since God through Jordan leadeth me. I don't know why that's there.
It's like his friend or something brought him to Christ.
Nice. You know, if that were what it was, I would support it 100%. Said it was his friend who brought him to Christ. That would be excellent. No, he's talking about the Jordan River. God through Jordan Lee. Yes. Maybe I can sing this with an entirely new understanding. That is fantastic. No, really, it's because there's a type of teaching, a type of theology that was very popular, that everything was a symbol of something. And the Bible was not to be understood for just what it said. It was to be understood in some greater, grander, glorious way. Now, there are some things that are types, figures, and shadows. I will fully agree with that. But I do not think that crossing the Jordan is a type, figure, or shadow of our entrance into heaven, which is what that hymn writer was talking about. But that's what they were taught. So that's why that verse was written that way. So I understand what the person's saying, but I want us to be careful. And now I want us to actually think about the words we sing. We didn't even know that we were even singing that. That's pretty sad. Okay. It's basically time to bring this to a close. We have 5 pages of outlines to go over, but we will not be doing that this evening. I could pull a Pastor Bryant and do them anyway. Okay, we've got 7 minutes. Let's see how far we can get. No, we're not going to do that. Oh, love to pick on you, Jim. Okay, any final statements, questions that don't begin with the word why or another interrogative word that means why?
I hope this doesn't come across as why.
Okay.
You were saying that Babylon is the only nation that has future?
If I did, I didn't mean to say that. It's a nation that's not on the earth today.
Okay, that's what I was looking for. Couldn't you say that Iraq is Babylon? Because it also talks about Rome, and Rome has also fallen. Does it have to bear the same name? Can it just be...
I'm not sure. That's a good question. I'm not sure. I would not say Iraq is the Babylon of Revelation. I wouldn't. If it is, and I'm shown to be wrong, I won't be disappointed. That's getting a little bit more difficult to put my stamp of approval on, but I do know that Peter used the expression Babylon to mean Rome. So can Rome and are Rome and Babylon the same? I don't know. Because in Daniel's statue, in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, the head of gold is Babylon, but the feet of bronze, the feet of iron is Rome. And are we the revived Roman Empire? We are very Western. We are very Roman. Are we Rome? And are we Babylon? Well, now we're getting a little bit beyond my ability to make the connection. I would say one thing to protect yourself against that is make sure that there's biblical support for it. I know the rock is Christ because Paul said so. I know the Passover lamb speaks of Christ because Paul said so. I know the sacrifices speak of Christ because Hebrews says so. That would be one thing to protect yourself. The second thing is, let the Bible speak for itself. Don't try to read into it more than is there. Read it as if you were the audience to whom it was written. And to whom was Joshua, the book of Joshua, written? It's written to Israelites so that they would remember who God was, even as some of the children were saying tonight. Read it so that you know who God is. Not so that you come up with something fanciful and pad your pride and ego that you came up with a new and enlightening interpretation. Just humbly and simply accept what God says about himself and rejoice in him. Let the Bible speak for itself. Any other questions, comments, disagreements, disputations, slings and arrows? Okay, well, thank you for coming out. Did you want to do something for Sadie? Yeah, well, I'm just sort of punching the period at the end of the sentence. Did you want to say something about Sadie leaving?
You just did.
Yeah, I know.
Dear lady right here, Sadie, or Velocity Sonny, is that how you pronounce that? Sort of close? She's been with us now for some time. She's going home to Nigeria, her home country, and she'll be there for 10 months. And so, in fact, I asked her to come tonight because she couldn't come this morning.
Thank you for coming tonight. That's what I was